You're listening to The Profile.
Welcome to the Leadership Special, where Christian leaders find strength, wisdom, and encouragement to lead with grace, courage, and purpose. I'm Andy Peck, your host, and I've had the privilege of interviewing nearly 1,000 guests over the last 20 years on various aspects of their leadership activity and journey. So whether you have a leadership title or are simply aiming to use the influence you have wisely, I hope you'll enjoy this next conversation and join us again next week. It's my joy to welcome you to another conversation designed to support and encourage Christians who lead. Let me start with a question. Do you want your leadership to be relevant to the needs of those you're serving? You're probably thinking, well, yeah, that's pretty obvious. But what about the issues that fill the minds and hearts of your people generated by the media? Or in other words, are you happy to engage in issues that might be labelled political? Some Christians in leadership cannot get away from the politics because of the charity or the work they're engaged in. But what about church leaders? We know that our faith very much needs to be articulated in the public square, but does that mean addressing issues in the pulpit? The UK church has typically been wary of this. The US less so, with the death of Charlie Kirk on September 10th, an American right-wing political activist who was open about his Christian faith, generating much comment. But things may be changing. In the UK, when Tommy Robinson staged a mass gathering under the banner Unite the Kingdom, more than 150,000 people attended. The rally included Christian symbolism with crosses, Bible verses quoted, worship songs sung, some even dressed as crusaders. A Christian leader is wise not to alienate his or her people, but can they stay clear of political comment when the Bible passage in front of them warrants contemporary application? Well, I'm delighted to be joined today by Andy Hickford, who now heads up the ministry Jubilee Leadership, having served in church-based ministry for some 37 years. We were at Bible College at the same time, so it's a delight to have him back on the show. So welcome, Andy.
Hi, Andy. Thanks very much for having me.
We'll look a little later at your work with Jubilee. Thanks for agreeing to tackle this issue. I don't know if you know what you've let yourself in for, but...
My wife asked me a similar question.
Okay, so, well, we very rarely look to politics, if you know, on the leadership show, for good reason, but it's kind of, in some respects, it's come to us, I think, in this contemporary world. So yes. Let me ask first, as a church pastor, how often did you look at issues that might be labelled political?
Well, thanks, Andy. So I was, as you say, I was in pastoral ministry for 37 years, and for the last 27 of those years was preaching most weeks. And as I thought about your question, I think it's really important to affirm again that the primary job of a Christian leader, the primary job of a preacher teacher, is to faithfully open up the scriptures, help people understand what it meant then, because it can never mean now what it didn't mean then, and point people remorselessly to Jesus, who is the way, the truth, and the life. That's our job. But as Spurgeon's recognized when he said, you know, you have to have the Bible in one hand and a newspaper in the other, if you do that job faithfully, if you're trying to equip people to help them see and experience their work, the world and their lives through a Jesus lens, through a biblical worldview, then you will inevitably, come up against issues which could be labelled political. So as I thought through my time as a local church pastor, I thought that there were moments actually when we stopped the teaching series to address something that was going on in the nation at that moment. So, for example, the death of Princess Diana and that remarkable week afterwards, we just wanted to stop and say, what on earth is going on in our country right now? When the riots happened, we did the same. When war started in Ukraine, we did the same. With Black Lives Matter, with Brexit. And so there were moments of a real crisis in our nation where we felt it was appropriate to stop what we were normally teaching and address something directly. And then I thought about, you know, actually every general election, we interrupted the flow of things to help people prayerfully and biblically reflect on what should our priorities be as we go to put our make our vote. And so never telling people how to vote, obviously, because Christians can agree, for example, that care for the poor is an important biblical principle, but political parties will have different answers to how they go about it. So Christians are always going to disagree. But it was, I think, the aim of our approach was just to make sure that people were making sure that their vote was part of their discipleship. And then there would be other times when we would be preaching on a text, but actually it lended itself to talking about, for example, the growing gap between rich and poor, or what could be called a moral issue around, euthanasia or abortion. There could be identity issues around, the woke ideology. Sometimes that would come up as an occasional point, but overall, over 37 years, the focus was remorselessly on pointing people to Jesus by faithfully dealing with scripture. And I think that always has to be our primary focus.
Andy, I guess to some extent there will be those who would never have done the things you did. So well done, in, if I can use that phrase. Again, other views are available, but some never did ever look at Brexit or the general election. They just carried on. If they're in the middle of Romans, they carried on in Romans. You had a, if I may say, a kind of an enlightened or a different sort of approach to many. So well done.
Well, there is an approach to Christianity which is still selling out to a sacred secular divide and
Sure.
tries to make a Sunday service a little bubble of isolation from the
Yeah.
realities of our world. And so we don't equip people to follow Jesus in that world. I was coaching at the start of this year the senior partner in a very successful law firm who said to me, I was down for intercessory prayers on Sunday and I didn't know what to say. So I told him, the vicar, that I wouldn't do it.
Oh, bless
Now,
him. All right.
that's a senior partner in a law firm. And I want to ask the question, what's their formation? What's their spiritual formation been like? What have we been doing as a church, which meant that they didn't, such an intelligent, successful person didn't feel equipped to lead the church in prayers around contemporary issues. Really
Sure.
interesting.
Oh, bless you. Yeah. Well, bless him. So the kind of principles that might govern a leader's decision to engage one way or another, because you've obviously selected those things, and to some extent it may be this is headline news. Did you have any particular principles, or did you to kind of go with your gut as each issue came up?
No, I think there were some very important principles. I think it was Jim Packer who said, always doubt your motives. So I think this is where team leadership in a church is really important. If I was thinking about interrupting a series, that's not a decision I would make on my own. I would be accountable to, in my case, an eldership. There were others with whom I would run that past, so we would make a judgment together. I think that's very important. I think if you're aware that you are just longing to make a political point, then that really should be having a lot of red warning lights going off. That's not our job normally. But if you are looking to help people think through things biblically, help people to follow Jesus, then you're on stronger ground. And the aim was always to help people reflect more deeply on what they were thinking rather than to direct their behavior.
Okay.
And so I think, we just live in a world where opinions are strongly held but weakly formed.
Yes.
And just trying to help Christians think more deeply, I think that's a more honorable objective. I think the second principle is you have to read and listen widely in order to understand deeply. If you're going to say something on a Sunday, make sure it's worth saying and not something, just a pretty facile soundbite. I think the third principle that shaped the way we did this was really be entirely fair to even positions that you personally disagree with. in such a way that if you were to represent a view, anybody who held that view would say that's a really good reflection of what we believe. I think that is really incumbent on Christian leaders. And then, of course, what I was trying to do all the time was to show how Jesus transcends the options available. Tim Keller was so brilliant at this, that actually it's only Jesus who shows us a way out of the mess we're in. And he has things to affirm and things to question in each of the political stances that we encounter, and his is a better way. So you're trying to help people see the world and their lives through the lens of Jesus. And then the last principle I used to have was just to, if possible, give them something practical to do, something to read, something to listen to, or an action, which would be a constructive thing towards. Go and have a cup of coffee with someone who is going to vote differently to you during Brexit, for example, and have a conversation. And all you're trying to do is understand why they're voting the way they are.
Sure. Part of the reason for this conversation, of course, is the Christian nationalism that has kind of invaded our land to some extent. Any thoughts on that, given what you just said?
How long have we got?
Well, indeed, yeah. And yes. So, what do you make of it, I suppose, is what I'm asking, rather than what do you believe?
So last week, Andy, I got a phone call from a vicar in a northeast town who said, "I've woken up this morning and our church and graveyard is completely surrounded by St. George's flags." He said, "Now, my congregation is made up of half of people who I suspect will vote reform, and the other half are immigrants and asylum seekers. What do I do?"
Oh boy, right.
So I've been thinking and reading about this a lot, and I'm by no means an expert on it, but I think we can say some things with clarity. To any Christian leader out there, I think we can say that the landscape has radically changed, and we're not in the same country and world operating on the same basis that we were even 5 years ago. And that we are currently on the back foot, and we quickly need to get onto the front foot. And there are two things that are radically different to the world in which I was pastoring for 37 years. The first is that we are experiencing what the Bible Society calls this quiet revival. I was working with a vicar yesterday morning who baptized nine people on Sunday, and I think that was the third or fourth baptism of the year. They're growing by 10% every 6 months. There is something happening in the nation, which is just wonderful. And at the same time, we have then this rise of what's called Christian nationalism. So let me just say some very basic things about that notion of Christian nationalism. The first thing is that that is a very broad title covering a lot of different people. And the Evangelical Alliance cross-section podcast has done a very good job at just giving some breadth to that. And they did this great thing about how there are some Christian nationalists who have a big C and a little N. So, in other words, they're devoted followers of Jesus and broadly, sympathetic to actually the nation's pretty broken and we need a more radical fixing. And then you've got the small C and the big N, and that's that group of people. That's the difference between the 7.5% of the population who go to church and the 47 who identify in the census as Christian. They're nominally Christian, but they're big on the nationalism. They go through these various options: big C's, little N's, big N's, little C's and little N's, big C's, big N. It's really good because it just reminds us that we have to be very careful about how we talk about Christian nationalism, because it's a very broad church, if I can put it that way.
Sure.
The second thing to say is that this is actually part of a far bigger movement across the world, which commentators are calling a great realignment, which has seismic implications for all institutions. Political parties are scrambling at the moment, as well as the church, for example. And basically, the idea is that in this huge, great seismic realignment, the old political divide of whether you were basically a socialist or a capitalist, well, that is long gone. That doesn't exist anymore. And basically, you've got now the emergence of two new broad groups, which is the anywheres and the somewheres, as some commentators call them, or in other commentators call them the cosmopolitans and the community nationalists. And basically, the anywheres, the cosmopolitans, they tend to be university educated, they're mobile, their identity is constructed around their own achievement, their careers, and so their identity moves with them wherever they go in the world. They value individual freedom and choice. They're the citizens of a global village, they're socially liberal, more at ease with woke culture, typically. These are broad brushstrokes. Now, the other group, the somewheres, the community nationalists, they're more strongly linked to the grassroots sense of identity and where they belong. They're attached there. Then they are less likely to have gone to university. And they have found themselves more and more excluded from economic progress and the cultural diversity of the nation. Their core values are group loyalty, security, and they're socially tend to be more conservative. They're, less at ease with woke culture, for example. And so what we saw clearly in the referendum when these two came head to head is now actually being writ large. And Christianity is being appealed to by the kind of community nationalists. Because it's a way of saying we want to stop the slide into what people see as a failing multiculturalism with its many religions, stopping the slide into woke culture and returning to our historical identity as a Christian nation, with laws and values derived from the Bible. So that's basically why Christianity is suddenly getting politicized. I was amazed on that Unite the Kingdom march that you referred to earlier, where the Sky reporter just watched as clerics led the crowd in the Lord's Prayer and then they marched off to the chant that Christ is King. And the Sky News reporter just said, "I've seen this in the States, but I've never seen it in the UK." Now, he clearly hadn't been to Northern Ireland because that's been a while. Around for a while in Northern Ireland, but there's something new happening here, and there are many who are fearful, and I include myself in this, that just when the quiet revival is starting to get going, that it could be hijacked and derailed by a political agenda. That's the big fear that's around. So I guess the question is, so what do we do? How do we respond to that, Andy? And I think we've got to be really, really careful about lazy, ill-informed, knee-jerk responses. There are some powerful state players who are manipulating our algorithms on the social media to do everything they can to make sure that we're a divided nation, because as Jesus said, a divided nation won't stand, it will fall. I think there is a real crisis here. We are in a real pickle right now, so we have to be really careful. I was talking to a pastor this week in a South Coast town who every Saturday morning on the seafront where all the asylum seekers are in a hotel, there are a group who are just protesting about their presence, and there is a group standing there to identify in solidarity with the asylum seekers. And his comment to me yesterday was, "It is vicious. It's really vicious. We're in real trouble. This is a crisis. So how do we respond?" The thing that has come through to me as I've been reading and thinking about this, Andy, religious nationalism might be new to us, but it's not to Jesus. Jesus was always coming up against the nationalistic agenda with his even with his own disciples. It was so deeply embedded, as you know, in the way they thought about Jesus. That's why they could never hear about his death on the cross. They couldn't reconcile their idea of a political Messiah who was going to duff over the Romans with Jesus' idea of messiahship. So the disciples of Jesus, at least some of them, were partly right and partly wrong. They were absolutely right that Jesus was the long-awaited Messiah. They were hopelessly wrong about what that messiahship would look like. He wasn't going to lead a revolution which overthrew the Romans. Even after the resurrection, Andy, as you know, in that those early parts of Acts, Jesus is about to ascend in heaven, and the disciples say to him, "Is it now that you're going to restore the kingdom to Israel?" I
Yes.
mean, oh, for goodness sake, if I was Jesus, that would have been a John Cleese moment where I was smashing my head against a wall. What will it take for you guys to get this? And actually, I think that speaks very powerfully into our cultural moment right now. With at least some of the disciples, nationalism seems to have been part of the thinking that encouraged them to be disciples of Jesus in the first place. And then there followed a 3-year-long process of separating out the misunderstandings as they learned to follow Jesus in practice, the real Jesus, not the one they imagined. And if we take that, then this moment shines lots of new light onto old gospel stories. So, for example, that the anointing of Jesus in John chapter 12, where Mary cuts through the celebrations and anoints his feet with perfume. What's going on there? Well, if you've just raised Lazarus from the dead, if that party's happening in Simon the leper's house, as Luke tells us, and Simon's been healed of leprosy, this is the Messiah. And it's just before fast Passover when they were celebrating the last deliverance of Israel. That party in Bethany is a revolutionary party because they think that Jesus is about to overthrow the Romans. And what does Mary do? She embalms him. She takes a very expensive jar of perfume used in embalming dead bodies and breaks through the party atmosphere and says, "No, this is what the kind of Messiah he is." And I think we are in that moment as a church where we're looking for our jar of perfume. We're looking for what is the prophetic action which cuts through this Christian nationalism. Yes, Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. Yes, lives do work better when we understand he knows better how to live our lives than we do. But he does not come in the way that many on the right portray him. And so I'm looking for how do we respond? And there's something here about the healing presence of a healthy church congregation. When Paul said, "There is no Jew, no Greek, no male or female, no slave nor free, we're all one in Christ." The local church is probably the only place in the country right now where asylum seekers and reform voters will be on first name terms. It's probably the only place where people who put up flags and people who are here as a result of immigration will come together on a Sunday morning to worship Jesus. There is something about if we can begin to model how to disagree without being disagreeable, how to love one another, how to talk deeply, how to listen to one another. If we can be, we will be like a healing oil, a balm that comes over this deeply divided, angry country. There's so much fear, there's so much anger, there's so much bitterness on both sides. We need the presence of a fully functioning church, not one that sweeps this issue under the carpet, but actually says, honestly, there'll be different opinions in this congregation, but Jesus always trumps those opinions. The way to common ground is higher ground. Let's come to him. I do really believe that church done well, congregational life as it's meant to be, can be for the healing of the nations. And I think there's a real thing that we need to focus on there as church leaders. How do we facilitate those kinds of conversations which are now never taking place because of our social media burrows, and if we can do that, then I think we're going to be in a really prophetic place as we respond to Christian nationalism. Sorry, that's a long reflection, Andy, but and there's so much more to say, and I'll be flagging up some more examples of this And I'm going to be writing a bit about this on our website. So,
Excellent. Well, thank you. I mean, that's a lovely summary, and if I can use those words, lovely, of the situation and some solutions as well, which is really, really helpful. So let's move, Andy, to the ministry that God has called you to. You moved along the south coast from Worthing to Torquay, some 180 miles, and having ended your time with a church in Torquay, you're now heading up Jubilee Leadership. So how did that come about, and what do you aim to do?
yeah, it came about unexpectedly, really. Karis and I, my wife and I, went away on a prayer retreat, just looking at this next chapter of our lives and what God was calling us to. And surprisingly, we really felt very strongly that we were to invest in Christian leadership. That was the calling. And so we came to Devon with the specific agenda to renovate an old property that used to belong to my grandparents in the Blackdown Hills, miles away from anywhere, to turn it into a sanctuary and academy for leaders. And this idea of Jubilee leadership was born, where the year of Jubilee in the Bible is all about resting the land, restoring property, and releasing the captives. And so rest, restore, release with Christian leaders is what we're about, basically. So we live here. We offer restorative hospitality at the cottage. I coach and mentor Christian leaders. I do consultancy and training for church leadership teams. And that's our life now. And it's been this amazing adventure to see how God has provided as we've gone on that journey.
I mean, well done for lasting 37 years in church-based ministry. I lasted just 7. And for me, the big challenge was the high level of expectation to lead over a whole range of areas. It seems to me that in some cases, the complexity of pastoral ministry has increased since even my day. What do you say to those who come to you who are frankly overwhelmed?
I think it's more about giving people space and time. It's more about listening and being present and validating their struggles. I have never done anything as hard as being a pastor in a local church, and I was regularly at my wit's end. There's nobody who knows your situation as well as you do, so you'd be very skeptical about quick fixes and easy solutions. But actually, just having a place where you could pause, be still, and talk to someone who knows the territory, who doesn't need an explanation.
Sure, yeah.
I think that's where it starts. So our job is to give leaders time and space to think things through, not deliver quick fixes, but always to encourage them that Jesus is present and he is at work. And it seems that the way the Lord works is that he gets us to the end of our tether to make us listen, and that each crisis is an opportunity to be refined both in our gifting and character to be more like him and more empowered by him. And that's the privilege we have as we walk alongside people on that journey.
And a geographic change, i.e., coming to your place, actually facilitates that to some extent in a way that you're not going to do if you're just taking half a day but based at home or wherever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we're on a little country lane that goes nowhere. We've got about three neighbors within about half a mile. It's quiet and fields all around. And yes, we pray that this will be a thin place for people to meet with Jesus here.
And how do people get in touch?
So just through the website, really, Andy, jubileeleadership.co.uk. And yeah, that's where we have our sort of main online presence.
Great. Well, it's been terrific to chat with you again. Thank you so much for the wisdom that you've shared on these tough areas and for suggesting ways in which leaders can think these things through and approach these things with their congregations. I think people tend to shy away from politics because they're fearful about opinions, when actually it's helping the people, as you said, helping people to think through before God what they need to think. And that's so helpful. So thank you so much.
Bless you, Andy. It's been good to talk.
It was super to speak with Andy Hickford. He now heads up Jubilee Leadership. Website again is jubileeleadership.co.uk for you want to get in touch with him. I think he highlighted some really helpful core principles when touching on political issues. Those words, read widely and be fair to both sides, I think is salutary advice to anyone who wants to dip their toe into politics. And hopefully, if you're in church leadership, that will help you as you seek to give perspective on some of the current issues that your members of your church are facing. So this is Andy Peck. Thank you for your company. Looking forward very much to the next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.